So I just want to say, I feel good about the Republican Party. I feel good about where we're going as a nation. We're killing all the right people and we're cutting your taxes.
That was Lindsey Graham last month bragging about how he was really happy about the Republican Party, where we're going, and led off with, we are killing all the right people. And that is an applause line. I'm not sure what's going on with that. And we have to try to figure some of this stuff out. We have back on the show with us Dan McKnight, great American patriot, host of the new Defend the Guard podcast and founder and chairman of Troops Home USA and Bring Our Troops Home. Love what this guy stands for. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Danny, thanks for having me on.
Hey, listen, for some of our folks who may not be aware, can you tell us a little bit about this new organization that you have?
Yep. The organization is called Bring Our Troops Home. We're a group of mostly global war on terror veterans. They got tired of the undeclared and endless wars, and we advocate with our voices for a return of constitutional war powers, going back to Congress where it belongs. And the way we do that is not by fighting in Washington, D.C. We fight in the states because D.C. is a swamp and it's not favorable ground. And we do it in the states by sponsoring the Defend the Guard legislation, which is a bill, if passed in the states, that would keep the National Guard from Idaho or Texas or whichever state it passes in from being released into federal service if the purpose is to deploy them overseas to fight in a war that hasn't been declared. And we've got the bill introduced in over 30 states. We're probably going to get real close to the finish line in Idaho and Arizona this year, maybe even Tennessee. And we're growing every single day. In fact, to help push this cause, like you said, we just launched the brand new Bring Our Troops Home podcast, and our audience is growing, our support is growing, and every time we show up to pass a bill, Danny, they send a two-star general to testify against us. So it's just little old Sergeant McKnight against a two-star general, and we square off and go face-to-face. It's pretty fun.
Well, I was there from one of those. Yes, I think it was a couple of years ago with Senator Rand Paul that you had to go there. I think it was Minnesota.
It was Wyoming.
Wyoming. Yeah,
We launched the campaign against Liz Cheney. That was the exact same time. And by the way, Dan, I don't know if anybody remembers, but we beat her by 37 points in the primary.
But who's counting, right?
Who's counting? Yeah.
Right. I remember you talking about some of that. So the little Dan McKnight Sergeant, I think, does have some pretty big sway here and is racking up some big time successes. But we definitely wish you more because we are strong advocates of following the U.S. Constitution, period, on this channel. And are great to happy to have you on today as well. Well, listen, one of the reasons I specifically wanted to have you on today, though, is because I've been looking at some of the stuff you've been having online. You did something on Dick Cheney, by the way, which we also talked about that. We're going to actually talk about that toward the end of the show, what you've been doing with that. But the other issue that I really wanted to focus on is that you're kind of talking about what does MAGA really equal in terms of conservatism, which Lindsey Graham seems to be having a different version of what I thought conservative actually meant, and how that turns into what is really America first. And I think that we've kind of gotten away from that. And I think people have been kind of going in their own direction. And I kind of wonder how you see this old issue of conservatives and America first.
Yeah, I think the Trumpism of today has kind of wrapped them both into one and they've been convoluted. The only thing that's conservative about Lindsey Graham, actually, I'm going to rephrase this. His drinking definitely isn't conservative. That man was sauced on that last video. Every time I see him in public anymore, he does seem like he's had a few too many drinks. But I think that in my belief, in my internal system, the way I've been preaching is that MAGA is a domestic frame of mind. Make America great again by bringing back manufacturing, by making things affordable, by getting the government out of the way of businesses and citizens and returning civil liberties and our privacy laws and returning America to what America is supposed to be. That's MAGA. But America first is outward looking. We do not need to go all around the world looking for monsters. We don't need to be spreading the empire. We should be building a tall border wall around our country, defending it vigorously, increasing our own industrial base, our military industrial base for home defense, and staying out of everybody else's business. Friends with everybody, alliances with none, and wishing everybody well. We can be that shining city on a hill that Reagan talked about, but we got to get out of people's backyards in order to do it.
Yeah, we actually, ironically, we did a show, I think it was just a week ago, where we highlighted on Reagan's comment there, where we said the exact same thing, that that's that still can be the aspiration for the U.S. And you see in that it went you know, a lot broader than just what's being talked about today. And it's a great roadmap for really everything you just said there. That's kind of what he was, and it worked pretty good for us when we actually applied that. Now, also, some of your words kind of sounded familiar for me for a different reason. It's something that just came out from the White House. And one of the problems that we have in our country today, Dan, if we can just be honest, is that sometimes our words, oftentimes our words and our deeds don't actually match. But sometimes if we listen to the words, they're good ones and stuff that should be followed. For example, in the just released, I think it was just yesterday, or maybe the day before, the new national security strategy that the Trump administration reversed. Now, this is some really good stuff here. And I want to focus on, we're not going to get into the whole thing. We're probably going to do a show on that later, but this is 33 pages. But there's two particular things I want to focus on here. If I can find it pretty quickly, if I hopefully didn't lose it. And that is something that I did lose, but I'm going to find it here. If you don't mind, give me just one. There it is here. And that is predisposition to non-interventionism. And I'll just read this part real quick here, because it says that predisposition to non-intervention in the Declaration of Independence, so a good place to start. America's founders laid down a clear preference for non-interventionism in the affairs of other nations, i.e. what Dan McNutt just said, and made clear the basis. Just as all human beings possess God-given equal natural rights, all nations are entitled by the laws of nature and nature's God to a separate and equal station with respect to one another. For a country whose interests are numerous and diverse as ours, rigid adherence to a non-interventionism is not possible, yet this predisposition should set a high bar for what constitutes justified intervention. How do you see that? Because it's not rigid. I'm all about not something that's rigid, but I am about focusing on non-intervention. How do you see it?
No, I agree. We are trying to find a way into several wars right now, you know, defending the Christians in Africa or Eastern Europe, or fighting some sort of a war in Central America, in Venezuela, or even Colombia. Now they're talking about, there's got to be a reason for us. If we're going to engage, there has to be a reason that's for national security, not because of wholesome and good reasons. Our job as a country is to defend our own. But this is where I draw the line. We have a mechanism for changing our nation from a condition of peace to war. If there is something that our nation feels so strongly about that we're willing to go to the Congo, or we're willing to go to Eastern Europe to go fight for some cause, if our populace, if the citizens, if all of us who have that God-given natural right, if we've given that authority to our representatives and we tell them in Congress, we want a declaration of war to go deal with whatever the threat is, if we believe in that collectively and our representatives vote on it, hey, that's the way our system works. What I disagree with is with one man, one person that we call the president, can make a decision to take us anywhere in the world based on some loose authorization or some justification is what they put in that document right there, righteous justification. It's so loosely defined that it can, any man, any woman leading the country can take us to a place that their benefactors, their supporters, their backers want us to go. And so I'm kind of a little bit of a interventionist in a way that if we want to go somewhere and we have a collective reason to do it, that the will of the people says we want America in our might, in our authority, in our name to go fight X, Y, or Z, then we should do it with the proper mechanism. And that's the one way I think that the anti-war doves or the non-interventionist doves and the hawks could all agree. Hey, if we're going to fight it, let's at least do it the right way. But I don't think we should be involved in all the places around the world, because if we got involved in every righteous justification, we'd be fighting in China right now trying to free the Uyghurs or some other place that we have no business being.
Well, yeah, and that's I think the issue that we kind of camp on here. I mean, anybody, any individual in this country of 340 some odd million people can have their opinion about what something's going to happen. But if I were the president and I had dictatorial powers, I could just determine we would do this, we wouldn't do that, we would go here. That might run afoul of a substantial portion of our population. And if we have a system to where I get to call the shots only, then we have, I think, in my view, the very system that our founders worked hard to prevent, which was, in fact, at vogue at the time, in 1776, when we first, you know, did the independence, was that the king or the sovereign could do that, and that could drag a country, even if nobody else wanted it, into a war that everybody else would have to pay the price for in blood and treasure. So it's something that we don't want. And yet, And this is not a knock on Donald Trump in particular, because this is something that Lindsey Graham actually bragged about recently in terms of whether we had the congressional or legal justification to go into Venezuela, should that happen. And he says, look, man, since 1973, War Powers Act was signed, which is something that I think is also a good adjunct to the Constitution because it clarifies some things. He said it's been violated 130 times. So, therefore, the 1973 War Powers Act doesn't apply. The Constitution doesn't apply. It's kind of an anachronistic deal. It's good on paper. But now that because we've done it this many times, ergo, we shouldn't do it anymore. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm going to ask you this question. How many murders were there in the United States last year?
A pretty big number. I don't know the number.
I would say thousands, maybe. Dozens of thousands. 15,000 is probably a good number to work with. Just because the murder being illegal has been violated 15,000 times or however many it was last year, does that give us justification to go out and murder? Lindsey Graham can't connect two dots if they are right in front of his face. First of all, he's probably seeing four. I'm going to say it again. The man's a drunk. But that justification, it gives no credence to his argument. Just because we have violated, because you people in Washington have violated your oath of office, doesn't mean we should continue doing it and it's okay. But I'll tell you what, Daddy, what it's going to take, it's going to take a movement, though. As long as we keep sending these bums to Washington, D.C., they're going to keep doing it because they're not there to represent the people. They're there to represent their interests. They're there to go to the fancy dinners, the limousine liberal stuff. They're there for their own ego. And Lindsey Graham's ego is definitely, definitely fed when he gets to stand in front of that microphone and put on that Southern charm and just, aw, shucks, we're cutting your taxes, but we're killing people too. Yuck, yuck. I mean, the guy, I can't stand him. He's one of the most evil Americans, and I hate that he has an R after his name. I really do.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, that going back again to why we have the Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Act, I think that they're important guardrails that, if followed, could really do a lot of things. Because if there's something, and I think you hit it right on the head, I don't think we should be going into Venezuela, but let's just say that a bunch of other people are really passionate that we do. Well, if our system says, all right, make your case. If you can convince enough people that they're going to go, ergo, through their representatives, and they pass something, because the War Powers Act is more prescriptive than the Constitution in that it says, unless there is a declaration of war, a congressional authorization, or we've been attacked, then and only then can the President of the United States, whoever it may be at that given time, then can he use military power against another country in that country. So if you believe that, then make your case. But if you don't make the case, then you don't get to go. And I think that's where we've lost the guardrail. It's just words on a paper.
That's right. And I think this evolution has been happening since World War II. This pushing the war powers into the executive branch, it's been growing consistently. And I think that it really kind of turned on its head around 2001. I mean, let's talk about the authorization of use of military force that Congress gave the president was such a vaguely written blank check that it gave the president the ability to take the military anywhere in the world to fight any person that he deemed a threat or a terrorist for any length of time with any amount of force. There was no restraint whatsoever. Now, do I believe that we should have reacted to 9/11 and gone to Afghanistan? Absolutely. I don't think Afghanistan attacked us, just the people that did happen to be there. But we should have been out of there by February of 2002. We completed the mission with the exception of killing Osama bin Laden. We can argue about whether we had him in our crosshairs or not, because you have to let him live if you want the war to go on. We know all the tinfoil hat stuff that I believe in, right? But you cannot allow the president to have that kind of authority, that kind of a blank check, and a Congress that absolutely abdicated the responsibility. They gave it away. They made themselves feckless. They castrated themselves. And the only way to get it back is we have to have a movement by the people to quit sending these guys to Washington, D.C. and demand that they take our authority back from the executive branch. It's ours. We gave it to Congress. It's ours from God. And they just willingly gave it away.
Right. Yeah. And that continues to go to this day. And certainly George Bush was maybe the original sin on that. But then Barack Obama enthusiastically took that same authorization and abused it in any number of other ways to continue doing anything that he wanted to. Just kind of kept it at a relatively low pace, but just continued to keep us active anywhere. And I mean, you can go anywhere from what we did in Syria, what we did back into Iraq again, Libya, et cetera. It's just kind of a lower scale, but it just continued to set the standard that there is no comprehension. There is no cost. And here's a problem that I have. And you started off mentioning the conservatives, and maybe we can bring them back into the conversation here. But whether it was conservative or liberal, none of the members of Congress, whether they're in power or out at the time of whoever's in the White House, ever stood up to say that's unconstitutional, don't do it. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, there were two. The original AUMF was opposed by one congresswoman from California, Democrat Barbara Lee, right? She said, don't do this. It's not right. You're giving the president a blank check and it's going to create an endless war. By God, she was right. In 2003, when we got ready to go to Iraq, one congressman submitted a declaration of war resolution and said, I'm putting this forward because this is the way we're supposed to do it. I'm going to vote against it, but I'm sponsoring it because this is what we're supposed to do. And that was Congressman Ron Paul. And they laughed him right out of the room. And so there are examples where Congress has tried very weakly to reclaim that authority. But conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. They give the authority away to the man at the head of their party. It doesn't matter. You see, the Democrats right now are absolutely opposed to the way the president's using the military, the way he's using the National Guard in D.C., Chicago, L.A., all these other places. But when Biden was president, they couldn't have cared less how he used the National Guard, or that he was kicking people out for refusing to take a shot, or that he was ending people's careers because of political affiliation. Nobody cared about the president and how he misused the National Guard or the military right back then. But right now, I think we have an opportunity, though, where just enough people are pissed about the process on the right, that we might be able to stand up and do something about this. We might be able to reclaim a little bit of that authority, because let's be honest, optics right now aren't great for President Trump. Now, if you follow when Dan Bongino was in the media, he used to have the Bongino rule. When a story breaks, you don't comment it for at least 24 hours. No comments, because the facts always come out later. And when they talked about this second strike on the Venezuela fishing boat, that the illegal order that Hegseth gave, it appears that none of that is true now. And so the optics are bad for the Republicans at first. I think there's a division in the Republican Party on reclaiming the powers, but nobody wants to restrain the president of the United States when it's their guy. Like, I'm an intellectually honest guy. I'm going to call President Trump out every time he does something that violates the principles of the Constitution that I believe and fought for and bled and my friends died for. And so I'm in that position right now, Danny. I think you are too. That it doesn't matter who's at the top of the ticket for us. If they're there and they're acting wrong, we're going to call them out. And I'll say it right now. Nikki Haley's son was on Tucker Carlson the other day and called George W. Bush the worst president of the last century. I agree. And that's my guy in my party. He was the worst president because he destroyed the separations of power.
Yeah, he did. And I want to kind of move on to some of the other words that maybe that if we can have enough momentum that we can say, hey, look, sometimes words are important if they're acted on. And there are some other good words in that document. I want to go back to the national security strategy and look at one other aspect of it. And it's called flexible realism. U.S. policy will be realistic about what is possible and desirable to seek in its dealings with other nations. We seek good relations and peaceful commercial relations with nations of the world without imposing on them democratic or social change that differs widely from their traditions and history. We recognize and affirm that there is nothing inconsistent or hypocritical in acting in accordance with such realistic assessment or in maintaining good relations with countries whose governing systems and societies differ from ours, even as we push like-minded friends to uphold our shared norms, furthering our interest as we do so. Now, Dan, if we follow that, I think that's really good. That's a good framework from which to look at things. But then we got to say, how is that? That was just released, right? So it was apparently vetted and written, if not acknowledged by some of our senior foreign policy, diplomatic, military leaders. And yet when you look down south into Venezuela, do you see that framework being used down there?
You know, I don't. Sometimes words are beautiful. Sometimes words are a mask. And I think at this point in time, we're probably seeing a little bit of a mask, because you put things in there so you can look at them later and say, that's what we believed. And then they find a way to tie their correlation and causation together, that we did this because our document said that, even though it's a complete twisting of the words. And so, you know, realism, it starts at home. Let's just be honest with that. It talks about recognizing constraints, right? You have to prioritize national interests. You have to avoid ideological crusades abroad. These are parts of realism that you have to acknowledge. And if the administration is embracing realism, then the first realistic step is putting troops under constitutional control for constitutional purposes and keeping them at home to defend our interests. The problem with flexibility is you can say that our interests are in Antarctica. you can say that our interests are in the Eastern, the Horn of Africa. You have to be strong and firm when you talk about the realism. You can't be have flexible realism without having a definition of it. And it all comes back to that same thing. Take us abroad, but make the argument. Let the people give their informed consent. That's the realism I support.
And really that is, I think, of necessity should be tied to the whole America first. And look, I've actually had this conversation with some other folks on our show from different countries, and it seems like it should have been just a matter of course that every country should be concerned with its needs first. And that even includes NATO. NATO is a bloc and military alliance, whatever, but it's composed of 32 different countries, and each country is required to look after its interests first and not get themselves into something that's going to be antithetical to their interests if they don't view it as a positive thing to be associated with. But now that it doesn't seem like we're prioritized American interests as we are so much as at the desire to invest ourselves abroad in all of these possibilities. I think that you said a second ago, you can do these things, but does that actually lead to a benefit to our country?
Yeah, and benefit's always it's a touchy word because there's fiscal benefit, there's security benefits, there is holistic feeling benefits. What does the benefit mean? And it could be about making us feel good as a people and taking our goodness across the world. We're the shining light. We're delivering peace and democracy and baseball and apple pie. America might feel good about that, and that might be a benefit for us. But again, it doesn't matter what the benefit is. If the benefit is that we want to expand the empire, if the American people want that, that's what we should do. We have constraints. We have the guardrails. We have all the things, but they don't mean anything if the people that are supposed to be enforcing them and following them have no moral soul whatsoever. The Constitution to them is nothing but an obstacle. It's a piece of paper to get in the way. And so when they put these beautiful words on paper, like this new flexible realism, it sounds nice, but it doesn't mean anything if the people that have to follow it have no moral gumption. They have nothing inside of them that would hold them to the rules.
Well, especially, yeah, if we seem to be kind of shredding the rule of law wherever right. It seems to suit as well. And again, this is something that affects both parties equally. We could do a whole show on that by itself. But I'm just curious as to, especially as someone who's fought, someone who's lost friends in combat, how do you interpret or define, maybe a better word, how do you define what is actually America first when it comes to the cost-benefit balance between contemplating doing something overseas? And we'll just use the Venezuela thing since it's so hot in the news right now, but it could apply really to anywhere. What are the criteria that you use to, at least for yourself, decide what is in American interest to do that we should place that first?
You know, that's a great question. I just put out a long form article. You can find on my X account. It's at Troops Home US. It was titled, let me think about the title. It was MAGA versus America First and Why I Chose the Latter. Great article. We got a lot of traction from it. I define America first as the first question. And let me I'm going to back this up a little bit of an anecdote. I help legislators run for office. We find good people that believe like we do, that support Defend the Guard, and we help them get into office. And when I'm interviewing, I always tell them, ask them the same question first. It's more of a statement. When you're getting ready to vote for a piece of legislation, a motion, of anything at all, with my authority as my representative, I want you to ask a question to yourself first. This is the first question you ask. Does this vote, or will this vote, if it passes, return or restore or protect liberty for the people I represent? That's the foundation for the first question. And I like that question to be used in the America First argument too. When we're talking about anything, trade, negotiations, treaties, anything, the first question should be, does this protect, restore, or return liberty to the Americans and protect their interests first? And if it's yes, it's a flow chart. We move on from there. If it's a no, the conversation's over. It makes it really easy to overlook things like, should we send $800 billion to Ukraine? Well, does it restore liberty, freedom, protect Americans or their assets? Nope. Then we don't move on. That's the end of the debate. But it's hard to do that when we start with the end in sight. We start with the moral feel-goodness. And that's the problem, is we always start with feeling good because we're America. And if you follow the flow chart the other direction, I think you get a better response from everybody. I just don't think the people in Congress or the Senate have the ability to turn that flow chart upside down and start that way.
Well, okay. So given that flow chart, there was something in the news just yesterday with another veteran, General Jack Keane, who said, you know, I think that we should potentially put American troops in the line of fire and possibly get into a war with Ukraine in the future if there's peace again. Watch this.
Let's just assume that the Ukrainians are willing to make some concessions, and concessions over territory, for example. That means they're going to need some kind of security guarantees going forward. And so do your people understand that what we're trying to say is the Ukrainians, if they're going to make a deal with the Russians, because the Russians have always said, and believe me, I don't think for a minute, regardless of what deal the Russians make, they change this. Their intent is to take Ukraine and topple it. Maybe not in the near term if they make a deal, but eventually they will do that, likely post-Trump administration. So if that's the case, and everybody believes that, and I believe it, I think the Ukrainians believe it, I think the United States believes it, then you have to put something in place to prevent that from happening, and it has to be enduring over time. And what are we talking about? We're talking about U.S. and European air power. If there's a violation, they would strike. We're talking about forces on the ground on the Ukrainian side of the line to make certain if there's any penetration there, those forces are there, one, to deter it, but two, to stop it.
So based on that criteria you just listened to here, how does that set up for the citizens of the United States writ large to potentially put our troops in harm's way for the benefit of the regime in Kiev?
Well, I think Jack Keane is suffering from a little bit of muscle memory. I think that's the same argument that we use for, I don't know, every other war since World War II. Let's put equipment in the way so that it becomes a trigger. It's a hair trigger for the next conflict. You put an American troop on the in Ukraine, and the first time a Russian fires at or kills or threatens that U.S. soldier, guess what we have to do as a nation? We have to respond. That's what we do. We protect our own. So when you put our equipment and our people in harm's way, you're putting them there as a tripwire. And that's not something I agree with. I think that when you put that type of a tripwire between the world's largest nuclear powers, nothing good can come from it. People posture, people in power say things that they may not actually believe. They might peacock a little bit. And we see that with our current commander in chief right now. He likes to stand up and be the big man and pull Vladimir Putin in close with a handshake and get real close and dominate him with his height. Sometimes when you whip them out on the table, all they do is get smashed. And that's not something we want. So the American people are kind of done with these ideas. I think Trump was elected on the idea that we wouldn't be getting involved in these. He ran hard on that concept.
He did.
And the right wing, the libertarian Republicans, the far right conservatives, the younger generation who absolutely do not support this mindset at all. We're done with the ideas. We're not starting World War III to satisfy the ambitions of the same class of people who have already proved that they can't be trusted with unlimited power, and the ones that will always send somebody else's sons and daughters in to fight.
And what would you, let's back up a little bit further, and back when the decision was really made on this, you had Joe Biden, then president, when this war kicked off, right before it did, he went out and told the American people and all the Western media that our intelligence showed that Russia was just about to launch a war. And if they do, then we're going to really start to put the hammer down and go against Russia, et cetera. And then you saw, I think it was about a month in, where Biden in Poland said, you know, my God, this man cannot stay in office. So we're going to continue to support until we can weaken Russia, et cetera. How would that, because this is a little bit more dicey, a little bit more, I guess, gray zone. How would you have applied those your criteria to what Biden was doing in the very first months of the war?
Well, I think he was posturing. I think he was trying to make an argument why the American people needed to support this, right? I think he was trying to draw it home that, you know, if we let Vladimir Putin march one more inch to the west, that's America being threatened. That's NATO being threatened. And when NATO's threatened, America's threatened. And when America's threatened, Joe Schmo in Iowa in the cornfield, you're threatened. And so he wanted to posture it up and kind of sell that to the American people. It didn't matter, though, because he was going to do what he was going to do, whether the American people supported it or not. And that's the problem with that that unlimited power that we've given the president, the foreign policy establishment, you know, the Project for a New American Century and the Committee on Foreign Relations, those polite society folks that run the foreign policy mechanisms inside the government. They're all about growing and expanding the American footprint all around the world at a barrel of a gun. That is not what a peaceful nation does. It's not a benefit to us at home. And if anybody has read history at all, Look at Rome. What happened to Rome? Rome fell because the politicians at home were having orgies and all kinds of debauchery while they were sending their military out to conquer the world. They spread themselves so thin that the enemy walked right in, right across the border and took over the cities. And so we have to limit ourselves. The desire to become an empire, the desire to turn the entire world into an image of America is what will ultimately destroy America. America is great because we're protected by two giant oceans. We were founded by God. We have a constitution that protects our liberties and our freedoms and our natural rights. What makes America troublesome is the people in power that don't quite understand that, that they want more power, more expansion, more influence. And there's been senators throughout history, starting after World War I, the incorrigibles that said we should be looking inside. We should be returning to America. We should be taking care of Americans. You shouldn't get off the subway station in Washington, D.C. and step over homeless people on your way to the Capitol building. Our America should be a beautiful example of lawful order, of prosperity, of unlimited freedom, the ability to send your kids to whatever school you want. But instead, we watch the news and we fight about Ukraine and we fight about some other country. And you walk up and down the congressional halls in Washington, D.C., and almost every damn senator and congressman has a flag from another nation outside their door. I don't understand that. You're elected by the people of Idaho or California or Utah. You should have your country's flag, your state's flags. That's it. There should be no more allegiance to anything else. And if any other congressman has an allegiance to another country at all, they should be thrown out of office.
Well, I would certainly encourage people to do that who have the power to do exactly what you suggest there. But it has become in vogue and it's become really popular to have the flags of all kinds of other countries in there because we've kind of made it part and parcel. It's just the way it's morphed into that. That's almost like positive. And so let me ask you a harder question here because it's one that's thrown up by these very advocates very often. And that's in, oh, so what are you saying? That we should just reward Russia's aggression and we should do nothing? That's Munich all over again. You just turn a blind eye to this and they will roll all the way over us. How does your version of America First answer that question?
You know, that is a tough one. But again, I'm going to fall back to my and this is the answer to all the questions. No matter how you phrase it, is it aliens coming from space? Is it the Russians from Eastern? Whatever it is, this is my answer. The American people send their representatives to Washington, D.C. with our authority. And they are there to execute on our desires. The majority of the people in their district that elected them, they are to go there and speak with our voice. And if the 2nd Congressional District of Idaho, which is Southeast Idaho, wants to take America into war, guess what? Congressman Mike Simpson, he's got their authority to make that happen. And if the people in the 3rd Congressional District of Utah do not want that, then their representative votes no. This is how it works. And if we would just return to that, I think these debates would almost be non-existent. If the people want it, we go do it. If we can get a legitimate vote to do it, we do it. But absent of that, what authority does the President of the United States have or the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or whoever else to put American troops and equipment in harm's way without the consent from the people? Nobody has that authority. But we've allowed them to take it. We've allowed them to expand on the constraints that are put in place by our founding fathers. And that's on us. That's our fault. Because if you let them take an inch, they're going to take a mile.
And they're like many miles now. And listen, I think that is absolutely the core of your argument that I love the most. And I think that is the reason why I think that the founders of our country would be cheering you on right about this point, because I think they intended it to be hard to get into war. So right. In your example that you just gave there, if the Idaho 1st Congressional District votes yes, but then the Idaho 2nd Congressional District votes no, then you're at an impasse, et cetera. The only way you can get us into war is if you have a majority of the congressional districts around the country that are voting yes. And to do that, you've got to make a really strong case. Right. In the event right now, let's go with Venezuela. If before President Trump could order anything to happen down there, he would first have to have congressional authorization. That would require him to make the case to the country, and then they would have to have the constituents for whatever means would have to make their vision known to their representatives, and then they would have to vote on it. This is going to take time, but it also means you've got to make the case. And if Americans say, I'm not convinced of that. I don't want to go to war and kill a bunch of people in Venezuela, something that could start this another Vietnam-type morass, something that we probably couldn't win, another Vietnam or Afghanistan kind of situation. Don't want to get into it. They would vote against it. So even if you had 30% of the country saying yes, you still don't have a majority. Unless you can make a really strong case, and it's hard, you're not going to go into Venezuela, but you'll still be required to keep us safe. There's not any change on that at all. That's the beauty of the system and why I'm so much of an advocate for what you're talking about here, because that could keep us out of stupid wars unless the people, a lot of them, are really convinced it's necessary. And then that's how the system is supposed to work. And then we can use the military only if that threshold is met.
That's right. And you look at some recent examples where the president in the national security team tried to make the argument to the American people. Starting on September 12th of 2001, they started selling the story. Well, they started long before that. They started in the late 90s that Saddam Hussein was building nukes and weapons of mass destruction and blah, blah, blah. But on September 12th, the CIA and the national security apparatus started saying that this war, this attack in New York and in D.C., means that Saddam Hussein needs to be removed from power. He needs to be killed. There needs to be an overthrow. We need to invade. That was the argument they started to make. And they painted that picture for 2 full years. 2 years they made that case to the American people. And the American people didn't buy it. We were split. It was 50-50. The America did not want that war. But guess what? They went anyway. And what happened? We found out that all of the intelligence that they were trying to sell to us was a lie. Every piece of it. The aluminum tubes, the enriched uranium from Niger, all of it. It was all fake. And so I think presidents and that want to take us into war, they know that making the case is hard. You're right. It should be hard. But guess that's why the process is the way it is. But here's another example. World War II, we got into war with a declaration of war from Congress in a matter of hours. So there are times when a declaration of war, when it's so obvious that it needs to happen, that even the dummies in Congress and the Senate can make the right decision to vote on it quickly. But other than that, the American people have no recourse whatsoever against George W. Bush. None. Because he went without our authority. He's gone in 8 years. That 90% of the people that signed that original AUMF in 2001 aren't in Congress anymore. What's our recourse? If we required a declaration of war to go, and let's say I wanted to go to war, and my representative voted against it, and then that war ended up being very just, very successful, swift victory, overwhelming force, you know, the Colin Powell doctrine. I could vote my bum out of office. You didn't support something that was obviously successful, obviously needed. Flip that on the other side, though. My representative votes for a war in Venezuela and I don't want it. And we go down there and it's another quagmire. We get to vote him out in 2 years. He's gone. That's why the power of the people is with their representatives. They have to answer to us every 2 years. And when this country was formed, congressmen weren't meant to live in Washington, D.C. They were meant to go there and come back and sell to the people what, you know, this is what we're doing. What are your interests? Let me take them back to D.C. They were meant to be a liaison, a representative. But now they get elected. They move in there. They get a high-rise apartment, and they never return to their districts. I haven't seen one of my senators in years. He's been in the Senate for 20 years. Oh, I haven't seen him in years.
Yeah, and you know that's the one of the other few times, maybe the only time, when Obama gave an example of how it can work. Now, I'm sure he had his political reasons to do so, but I specifically remember in 2013 when he was getting ready to bomb Syria, and he says, all right, well, we have to get congressional authorization for this first. And they actually did some hearings, and it didn't go anywhere. They said, no, we're not going to do that.
But he went anyway.
Well, eventually, but at least on that one set right there, it for the moment had worked until the political calculus changed, and then it's like they don't want to be handcuffed. But that's all the samples that you gave there are example of how the system works when it's done correctly. And one of the reasons why, that last thing you said there about how if your representative didn't vote for it, you could vote him out, or if he did and it didn't work, you could vote him out. That's one of the reasons why they don't vote. Don't want to put their name on anything, because then they don't want to be held accountable. So then whether it works, if it works, yay, I thought it was a great idea. If it didn't work, they said, oh, that bum shouldn't have done that. And then they try to claim credit one way or the other. So it's not so clear that you vote them out for that. But if we put them on the line, then they would be more at risk of that, and they would be less likely to go to war because it could go badly. Another reason to do what you suggest.
No, I couldn't agree more, Danny. I think we're completely aligned on this.
We truly are, and we need to get the members of the House of Representatives and the Senate online, and we need to get the White House online. And I don't know. I guess the only way we can get that is to get the people, first of all, from the bottom up, kind of moving that this is something that we want. And I fear, Dan, and I like your view on this before we let you go here, that the only way we get there is if the dysfunctional system or the absence of functioning, I don't even know if it's enough to be dysfunctional. We're just ignoring wholesale both the 1973 War Powers Act and the Constitution in this regard, is that we're going to get sucked into something in somewhere that's so egregious that the people revolt against all of these powers that be. And only then can we get back to a place where we can do it the right way so that we don't get into a situation where we get harmed anymore. Do you see a different path that we can get into to prevent that bad outcome?
No, that's the only path. It has to return to the people. The grassroots have got to rise, right? And that's why we don't fight in DC. We don't even bother with DC. DC is good for commentary and raising money. But other than that, there's no fight there that's worth getting into. That's why we fight in the states. Corey Mills, representative from Florida, Republican, veteran, possible stolen valor, proposed a new AUMF just a couple months ago narco-terrorism AUMF, where he wants the authority to fight against narco-terrorists in up to 60 countries around the world. It's out there. It's moving. They're doing the behind-the-scenes work right now trying to get this passed. If you want the National Guard and your troops, let's back up from there. If you want your military active duty fighting in 60 countries, first of all, you're crazy. And if we do pass it and we send the military off to fight in 2, 3, 5, 12 countries, where's the rest of the troops going to come from? They have to go to the states then and get our militia, our National Guard. And so if you want the National Guard from Alaska or Montana or Florida fighting in some third world country or Central or South America, you've got a problem. And the only way to stop that is to put a constitutional check in place, which exists, but we have to give the states the authority to have some muscle behind it. And that's why we fight in the states with Defend the Guard. If the military, the federal government wants to take the National Guard from Idaho to go fight in some narco-terrorism war in Central America, great. Pass a declaration of war or the Idaho National Guard stays home, period. That's why it's so important that we fight this in the states, because you can't do it in Washington, D.C. We don't have the power. We don't have the money. We don't have the influence. And truthfully, the political elite in Washington, D.C. don't listen to anything at all. You look at the Epstein vote just the other day as an example. Everybody's against it until Thomas Massie stands firm and forces the vote with MTG and Ro Khanna. And then all of a sudden, once it's out there and they have to put their names on the line, every single one of them, except for one, every single one of them did what their constituents wanted. You make them vote, but that's too hard to do in D.C. That's why we fight in the states, Danny. Is the only way I see that we can keep our country from marching headlong into all these adventures is to withdraw 50% of their ability to do it. 50% of the active duty or the military fighting force is the National Guard of the states. And if we put that constitutional check in place, we can stop it dead in its tracks.
Well, listen, you're the only one outside of Washington, D.C. that's having any kind of success. So we certainly wish you well. And where can people go if they want to learn more about what you offer?
Yep. If you want to just follow us in real time, it's on X at @troopshomeus. Our websites are bringourtroopshome.us and defendtheguard.us. And the brand new podcast, the Bring Our Troops Home podcast, is a great way to get good content. The first two episodes of a 6-part Dick Cheney series are up. It's called The Real Dick Cheney. We're putting out as much content as we can, but I would encourage people, go to defendtheguard.us and click sign the petition at the top and just put your name on the list of people that support this concept. And then we'll start sending you some newsletters. We get sent out about one a week, maybe two. Really good content about what's going on around the world in your country, in your state. So if you want to get involved in the Defend the Guard movement in your home, we've got the path to do it. And finally, if you can chip in a few bucks, either one of the websites, we are a small veteran-led organization. I volunteer all my time, 100%, and I have two paid people. And then I have a small paid consultant team, and we run on a shoestring budget. Chip in a few bucks, and it helps the fight for one more day.
Well, listen, we recommend people do that as well, because truly that's one of the places where your money can actually do something positive for the country. We certainly admire you and encourage people to go to your site to learn ways that you can actually make a difference. This is one of those places where it actually can have an impact and help our country. So we recommend that, and we thank you for what you've been doing, Dan. So thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. It was great being on. Good seeing you again.
Good to see you too. We will look forward to seeing you guys on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Thank you.